I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
One, two.
Apple Studios is now down to literally a MacBook Air with a one piece that extrudes to allow for a mic stand desktop and a small Neumann 103 and a little converter the size of a deck of cards zip-tied to the mic stand. So I can literally put it in a paper bag because I go skiing every Monday. So if I get a call to do a spot, I can jump in the car, which is a great recording studio. And it's unbelievable.
Holy
Everything
shit.
Is in that computer.
Wow. What was it when you started? What kind of gear did you have?
Oh, it couldn't possibly be mobile. It was, gee whiz, to record. When I first built the room in 87, it was a reel-to-reel 8-track machine. So I'm saying goodbye. So it's over.
Oh, the Zoom call.
Yeah.
So Mark Kaplow is on the podcast now. He's the bridge between the original PLR orange and black logo to today. Mark Kaplow started out as an intern during the legendary lineup and became a legend himself. He created Rent a DJ. So if you've been to a party or a wedding with a DJ in Connecticut, you probably have encountered his company. And also became one of the most sought-after voiceover talents in the country. It all started from you just interning at PLR.
Stumbling in as a 10th grader looking to fulfill my class requirements in independent study.
Why would you want to be at a radio station at that point?
It started when I actually was 13 and I had rheumatic fever. And I was bedridden for a year. And anybody who's ever spent any amount of time in bed knows your hours get wacky. And I would, find myself awake at 2 in the morning and asleep at 2 in the afternoon some days. And I would call WAVZ 1300 on your AM dial and win the quick quiz. And after, months of talking to these DJs, one in particular said, hey, when you get better, come down and take a tour of the station. And I walked in and saw the dials and saw the guy. It was kind of like that scene in American Graffiti when Richard Dreyfuss goes to see Wolfman Jack.
Right.
And it just, I was knocked out by the technology and the fact that this, guy sitting at a desk drinking a cup of coffee was keeping me company for the past 6 months.
Who was the DJ?
Art Page.
That doesn't ring a bell.
I ran into, 10 years later selling hot dogs down on Savin Rock.
Wow.
Yeah, and I guess radio didn't treat him well. He didn't have a lot of good things to say, but I was certainly grateful to him for the intro.
It's a tough sport. So then you end up at PLR as a 10th grader?
Yeah, now I'm all better. I'm back in school, and I walk into my 10th grade English class, and Mr. Gadsden says, we're going to do something different. It's called independent study. You pick something you want to study. You do a report on it, and we'll all talk about it at the end of the semester. And I said, can I study radio? And he said, sure. So PLR was a lot closer to my house than WAVZ, which is way downtown. PLR was about 2-3 blocks from the hospital. Where we grew up, dad was in and out of St. Ray's all the time as an MD. And PLR was exceedingly welcoming, friendly, open and generous with their time and expertise. So I studied on-air production, sales, news, and then did a report and was encouraged to keep doing it. So I really never stopped hanging around PLR.
So that's the Chapel Street, right? Chapel
1294
Street.
Chapel.
What was the lineup then?
Well, the first person I saw was not on air, but reception. But the reason I bring her up is because I always credit her with being my angel. Paula Schneider was the, and she was just on that Zoom call that we do every week.
I've heard that name many times.
She is an absolute angel. And if you're a 10th grader walking in not knowing which end is up, this is the woman you want to greet you. She was friendly, and she said, of course you can study us. Come on in. Jay Crawford was just getting off the air. Gordon Weingarth was just going on the air. And as it turned out, I was free the time of day that Gordon was going to be on.
Wow.
So they were just thinking about having somebody answering the phones to help the DJs out. And they were going to call it the listener line. And my slots, I think, were Tuesday and Thursday from 2 to 4 and just answering the phones, which rang nonstop. And then when the sheet was filled up, you'd bring it in and give it to Gordon. And I got to be around my heroes and watching them work. It was fantastic.
So that's Gordon Weingarth in the midday, Eddie Wazoo in the afternoon shift, Stoneman 6 to 10. And was that Doc Rock 10 to 2?
Yeah, and Marcia Simon, was doing morning. And they did jostle around a bit.
Right.
But, yeah, what you just described was pretty much the lineup that stuck. But, yeah, Doc Rock did mornings for a while.
He said he slept in a couple of times, and Gordon said maybe you should do nights instead.
Oh, man. But it was, yeah, it was a very organic thing. It was, you know, whatever worked. I remember when Stoney, and he got that name well-deserved, you'd look down at the back hall, and I'd be standing around getting ready to go at the end of my day, and the powers that be would be standing there. And I remember once one of the higher-ups said to me, if he bounces off the wall once, he'll be fine. If he bounces off the wall twice, stand by, because you might fill in for Stoneman. And you talk about quaking in your boots, hoping he didn't bounce on the wall the second time, because I would be petrified. But one day I did fill in for him, and it was like just getting launched into space. It was
right.
The biggest thrill of my life.
I remember I heard the first time you were on air at PLR. At least this is my memory of it. It was a Sunday night, and I don't know who was on, but they said the kid, Mark Kaplow, is coming on to do his first show on WPLR. He's been here for a while, but we're going to hear him on the air. I thought, wow, this is the first time this guy's going to be on the radio, and I get to hear it, you know?
I was probably squeaking like a mouse.
So that's when, late 70s?
I started, I walked in 74. I graduated in 76, and by then I was doing pretty routine part-time fill-in. But the lineup was so stable, you know,
right.
You could never hope to get a full-time job at PLR. It was just a dream. But to be able to fill in for people was fantastic. And that was all through the later 70s. But that was cool because I could still go and do gigs at night start really focusing on Rent a DJ. But yeah, whenever PLR called, it was like, wow, this is, I get to be on the air again. This is great. 78, 79. I didn't go full time until 80, maybe 81.
And that was, what did you do full time? Was that afternoons?
I started, Gordon took himself off the air so he could focus on being the program director. So I was doing middays for about 2-3 months and loving it. We got a new program director, and he said, I want to put you in afternoon drive. And I said, okay, whatever you say, boss. And that really became home. That was just because people are in the right mood, coming home from work, getting ready to pop a beer and have some fun at home, and you could really rock out. You know, everybody came at radio from a different place. Like, some guys were totally into the music, and they could name you every name on the liner card of every album. You know, Rick Allison comes to mind. Tragedy of Calabrese comes to mind. These guys know music in and out. My thing was, I liked hit radio, so I wasn't really much into deep tracks. I was just playing the stuff that, you know, you could, quote, dance to, which fit in good for afternoons, right? You know, party tunes. And back then it was, you know, everybody from Petty to Springsteen to the newer stuff, you know, newer stuff, Clash, to the Go-Go's, everybody in between. Clarence Clemons from the E Street Band was doing a solo project. He was absolutely by far my favorite interview. Because PLR was pretty much central to New York and Boston, all the big bands that were on tour would go from New York to Boston. And my new program director said, we're going to set it up so when these guys are on tour, when they play Toad's Place, we're going to have you interview them after they do their sound check, before they go out to dinner. And then you go down to Toad's Place and you'll introduce them. And that's how, you know, we'll you know, get some promotional value out of, you know, the station being tied to all these rock bands. I said, whatever you say, but, you know, I don't know a lot about rock and roll, boss. He said, don't worry, Rick Allison will write all your questions.
What was Rick Allison doing there at the time?
When I got back from Florida, because I went to Florida briefly, we bought a radio station, asked me to go down and work there until they got, you know, things up and running the way they wanted. But I couldn't wait to get back home. So I was gone from 82 to 83. And when I got back, Rick was doing, he was actually the program director when I was gone. But when I got back, he was doing mornings. Is that right? I don't remember. But I do know that he was the co-music director, because he and I would talk about music all the time. And I said, you got to write my questions. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about with these people.
So, but you were there during the original lineup. We talked about Marcia Simon, Gordon, Eddie Wazoo, Stoneman, Doc Rock. And then you were there after they were all gone, and you mentioned a new program director. There was this new program director replaced everybody.
Yeah, I think the decision was made for him as he came in. And it's like, look, we want to go from being more of an esoteric, you know, deep tracks, let the music really fade out and then talk. It was almost like public radio. Yeah. In that it was very really highbrow for real audiophiles that were interested in the music. And I kind of felt like a bit of an infidel because I was, you know, I was a kid. I grew up on Top 40.
Yeah.
And I sit down and I start playing, you know, Honky Tonk Woman, and I'm talking it up to the vocal.
Right.
And I bring my air check into Gordon, and he said, yeah, what is that?
What are you doing?
Yeah. I said, you know, like Imus does. I'm talking up the radio, talking up the song to the post. And he said, yeah, you want to not do that? The music is sacred. Don't talk over the music. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever you say, boss.
Yeah.
I mean, there were still, you know, folks doing what they were doing, but we weren't playing, you know, Jorma Kaukonen as much as we're now playing the Go-Go's and Joan Jett and Blondie. And stuff that you could hear. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was top 40 rock, but it was progressive rock with more of a broader appeal, I guess. The interviews that we got to do were really something. I remember there was a kid that came through from Ireland and his new band called U2. and I had a little trick that I learned by accident. I liked tea in the afternoon instead of coffee just for my throat, and I'd always have tea and honey in my cubicle. And I discovered by accident that, you know, when these Brits came in, offering them a cup of tea was like, whoa, this is cool. And the other thing I would do is, because all these rock bands had entourages, I would always ask them to wait outside so I could just be with the artist in the studio. And after we shut the door, I'd say, here's the deal. You're on the road. Why don't you just decompress? We're not going to go on the air. I got 10,000 records behind me. Tell me what you want me to play. What do you want to hear? And of course, they're all musicians, so they open up to it, and they start looking through the 10,000 albums. They're like, oh, man, you got this, you got that. And they've got so loose that when we did open the mic, they would just gush. It was wonderful. So, but yeah, you two, Bono and I were kind of joking. We were both 23 at the time, and we just kind of marveled at our situations. He was, you know, getting to live his dream, touring the States, and I said, you know, and I'm getting to live my dream. I'm a local kid, and this is my, like, you know, dream to be on PLR, and I finally made it after 4 years of waiting in the wings. So we're having a good chuckle at that. That was all back on Chapel Street.
And it was just normal. And yeah. You were there for the move from Chapel Street to Dixwell.
Yes.
You really bridged a lot of the PLR history. You came in when the station was just getting its legs. It was 2 or 3 years old. You were there and saw the original, you know, that lineup that people remember, the orange and black sticker. You became afternoon drive host. You were there with the move from Chapel Street to Dixwell Avenue. What was that like, moving a radio station?
Well, hats off to Dr. Dan, our engineer, who was probably the smartest technical person I've ever met. Then again, anybody that can change a needle on a record player amazes me. But he was the technical crew worked long and hard to make all that happen. So all we did was essentially, you know, hey, when you show up on Monday, here's the new address. It was very cool. And you know, being over a bank was a trip, too, because if you locked yourself out, which I did once, I went to tip the pizza guy, and the door closed behind me. And all I could do was just listen to the record fade out. And I'm thinking, how am I going to break into a bank? Thank God one of the salespeople was driving home and heard the dead air and, you know, thought something happened and let me in. It worked out.
So between your afternoon drive shift and your rented DJ and real estate businesses, you were doing pretty well. And I've heard some legendary stories about this boat that you had. And it seemed that Wiggy had a knack for breaking his leg when he was around you.
You know, you put a large man on a boat with a wet fiberglass deck, and you put about a quart of tequila in him, and you just, you know, sit back and watch the fun. He had more ways of ruining his legs than, it was pretty. In fact, my brother Joe, who was a surgical PA, took a trip with us once. And he finally got to diagnose Wiggy, and he said, you know, so what's the deal? One day you broke your ankle, one day you broke your knee. Well, what's happening? And he says, I don't know, Doc. And my brother Joe had him sit down, and he moved his calf, and he said, ah, here's your problem. he was just, whenever we left, the program director would always say to me, now bring him back unbroken this time. we went to Block Island, I think, at least once a month for a couple of years in the summers. We had a great time.
I saw him, you know, it got to be such a normal thing. I saw him once with a cast on, and I said, what happened? And he just looked at me and said, Capo. And I knew what that meant. It meant a lost weekend on a boat.
Yeah, it didn't take much for him to fall over.
And you guys had this thing called bonding night where you'd get together, I believe, on a Thursday and play pool at one of the houses, either Allison or yours, I think, or Wiggy's, right?
Yeah, it was when I got back from PLR, there was where the receptionist area used to be on Chapel Street. There was now a pool table. And the story was that Toad's Place had sent it over as a gift. And the new program director said, look, I don't want people playing pool in the lot. You know, you can hear it when you're on the air. You know, we got to get work done here. So this has got to go. And I said, well, you can't just, you know, get rid of it. He said, well, you take it then. I said, well, I'll take it as long as everybody here knows they can play anytime they want. And I was single at the time, so I put it in my living room. And I said to the guys, you know, you're welcome anytime. So it turned out to be Thursday nights at 7. And, yeah, we'd show up, and it was pretty much everybody. And that went on for years and years and years. And someone said, you know, this is male bonding at its finest. So that's what they were called, the bonding sessions.
Well, you were at, I believe this was at your house, you were at the bonding night that Wiggy left to throw me off the air. Do you remember that?
You know, sometimes you're supposed to, you know things that you're not supposed to know.
Yeah.
So my trick has always been purge it from your mind.
Yeah.
But I do recall him once, we were listening to the radio, and he was listening intently for some reason. And then I saw him scrunch up his face and say, son of a bitch. And then, excuse me, I've got to go fire someone. And he left. What was that all about?
I heard that you said to him, so he sat me down that day and air checked me and said a couple things. And he said, I don't want to hear you on the air tonight talking about this in your vindictive tone. I said, okay, boss. So I go on. And I talk about not being able to talk about it.
Okay.
About 20,
as you well should.
Right. About 20 minutes later, with his cowboy boots on, I feel the ceiling tile shaking like I'm in a Jurassic Park movie. And I look down the hall, and he's got that vein popping out, and he's screaming at me about 50 feet away, coming full speed down the hall. The interns run under the counters. And he says, did I or did I not tell you to not fucking talk about that on the air? And then now he's 3 inches from my face. He said,
really?
You get the fuck out of here right now. And you are off tomorrow. And don't call me Monday. And you could call me Tuesday to see if you still have a job.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was a great lesson because I just had two really great ratings books. I just took over. And you know, I was thinking my shit doesn't stink, and I get in the car, I'm driving down the road, and I hear a guy come on the air and start talking as if I never existed. And it was a great lesson at that point in my career to just know you could be replaced in a second, that it's really not that big of a deal that,
you know,
you have great ratings.
Now that you're bringing it up, I remember thinking to myself, he was a new PD because he was acting PD every time one of the PDs got fired.
Right.
And I said, Griffin, why don't you just be the PD? And you remember, well, I don't know if you do remember, but he would never wear a necktie, you know, always with the cowboy boots still to this day. But and he's like, you know, I don't know, I play in that world, and executive, I'm not me. And I said, Griff, here's the deal. You're good at it. You should do it. Play their game. And, like, put on a tie, you know, because you learn that in business management, you know, dress like the people that you take advice from, dress like your doctor, dress like the lawyer, you know what I mean? It's one of those things. I said, if you walk into a meeting with a tie on, management looks at you and says, oh, this guy's serious about being the PD. He's not just some crazy, you know, creative guy, which he's brilliant at. And sure enough, he got the gig. And his first job, honest to God, his first act of duty was to fire me. That was, you can ask him about it. Yeah.
I was an intern.
Upper management said, I know you and Kaplow are tight, but, you know, his time is up. You know, he wants to spend more time doing his, advertising and voiceover thing, and he's not paying attention to his show, and you got to tell him either he works, you know, here full time or he's out. And he was shaking like crazy. And he called me into his office. I'd just gotten back from a week-long vacation or 2 weeks vacation. I walk into his office with my key off my ring. And he's white as a ghost, Kaplow. You got to pay more attention. You got to come in at your show is from 3 to 7. You got to be here at 2, and you got to stay till 8. You got to do show prep, and you got to do this. Or you have to sign this paper that says you resign. And I said, okay. Let me sign the paper that says it, and here's my key. And he goes, Kaplow, I'm having a heart attack. I can't sleep for 2 weeks knowing I got to do this. I'm like, Griff, it's the test to see if you could be the boss. don't worry about it. You're doing us both a favor. It's time to go. And it was just a beautiful thing.
I remember I was an intern there for you. Well, there was interns all over the place, and the intern
right.
that was supposed to be doing some work for you that day was out. So I was taking the phone for you, and you're just so nice to work with. And it was really cool because I remember your first shift, and now here I am in the room with you and you asking me questions. And I said, well, I'm a DJ, I'm DJ Chaz. And I guess you saw like a couple of Keg House advertisements or whatever. You're like, oh, DJ Chaz. And you said it in the Capo voice. I'm like, well, now I've made it. Mark Capo is my name and his Mark Capo radio voice. But I was in the studio, and I believe it was the first time I saw a human being multitasking like you. You were on the phone talking to people about business. You'd say, hold on. You'd put the phone on hold, throw your headphones on, do a beautiful break, talk up, hit the post, put your headphones down, pick up the phone, and continue the conversation. I'm like, holy shit, this guy is together. So that time when you left, so when Wiggy fired you or you left or mutual, whatever.
He properly fired me, yeah.
And you went on to become one of the most sought-after voiceover talents in America. How did you do it?
Anybody that tells you otherwise is blowing smoke. It's a lot of luck. And you know what they say about luck is, you know, when you hear the knock, you answer it. And I was very fortunate. You know, I had wanted to do voiceovers forever, ever since I was a kid. But, you know, I'm a kid from New Haven, and this, you know, the people in New York are giants. They've got big, beautiful voices, and, you know, I'm a little squeaky kid. There's no way I'm ever going to be able to do that. But, hey, I can make commercials on PLR, and the clients tell me that, you know, their phone rings pretty good when I make a commercial, so I'm charging to make local commercials, and I'm doing okay at it, and I'm happy with that. And then one day, I get a call from Rick Allison, who says, my friend is a producer in New York, and he tells me there's a strike on, and the producers can't get any of the big voice guys to do jobs. And I said, well, what do they need? And today there's a Long John Silver's commercial and a Red Lobster commercial. And they need you to go audition, and I'm going. You want to go? And I said, I've got my tape ready, and I'll see you in the car at 9 a.m. And we get to New York, and I get to a big Manhattan recording studio, and I'm going to audition for Long John Silver. And I am so nervous. I huff and puff through it, and it's just a disgrace. And the audio engineer and the producer say, thank you very much. And I walk out, and then I'm walking to Gray Advertising, 777 3rd Avenue, to do a Red Lobster commercial. And I had enough time to walk there and say to myself, you little son of a bitch, you waited all your life to do this. Here you are, and you're going to freak out and just blow it. I don't think so. When you walk into that audition, you read the script, you're prepared, and then you lay it down like you own it. Got it. And I was so mad at myself from blowing that first audition. When I saw the Red Lobster copy, I read it over and over and over. And then she called me in, and I put on the headphones, and I just laid it down like I owned it. I wanted it so bad, and it just felt natural. You know, the copy was, you know, the copy in New York is brilliant. And I just I felt really good about the read. And I was like, oh, okay. That's better. You know, do that for a couple of years and maybe you'll get somewhere. And the woman said, that was very good. And I said, oh, thank you. And she said, could I see you? And so we both step out. I step out of my glass booth. She steps out of the control room and we're in the hall. And Rick Allison is there because he's auditioning for it as well. And she says, you're both very good. Where have you been? And we said, well, we're DJs from New Haven. And she said, well, here's the name of a couple of agents. Why don't you call them and get yourself an agent because you're going to do okay in this. And it was like, are you kidding? That's, you know, the casting director for Great Advertising. They handle all Red Lobster and Butterfinger candy bars and Zest soap. And we hired an agent that afternoon. And when I got home, there was a message on my machine saying, you have a booking for tomorrow for Red Lobster. And I was the voice of Red Lobster from that day on for the next 3-4 years.
Damn.
It was unbelievable.
Unreal. I heard your voice on everything. I mean, everything. You and Allison. I mean, you couldn't watch a network television show or turn on the radio without hearing you or Allison. I think they did an article on you guys. Someone, like a big newspaper. I don't know if it was the New York Times or someone did something on calling you guys the Twin Towers because you're both tall and both became very big in the business.
Yeah, there was somebody doing that. You're right. The New York Times did a feature story for their, Sunday magazine, which was, meet the voices, meet the faces behind the voices, behind the pitch, I think was the name of the article. And it was a huge, like a full page deal about all the, and I was just one of the announcers they interviewed, but they took a picture of, I was actually, at that time I was the voice of HBO. And I was at the studios they used, RMR, over on Fifth Avenue. And the photographer came up to take a picture. And I said, Rick's the one that you should take a picture of because it's his friend that knew the journalist that put him in touch. So you should be taking a picture of him, not me. And he didn't want anything. And Rick's very modest. So I said, we'll both take it. So we both stand at the mic, and it's a cool picture. I should put that on one of them there Facebook things.
You absolutely should. So I have the role, Mark, and this went by in a flash, and it's really exciting for me to talk to.
Great fun.
One of my radio heroes. Sometimes you meet people that you really respect in the business, and then they turn out to be not so great. I mean, you're the opposite. You're just so nice and kind and generous. Before we go, why is PLR so special?
In my opinion, there's been several PLRs. And the old adage, if you don't change, you die. If you don't, adapt or die. PLR has always been able to connect with people. I mean, radio in general is good at connecting with people, but PLR has always created an environment where they allow the people on the air to connect. Lappy and I have had this wonderful relationship where, we're a little hostile to each other, but it's fun. but we get a kick out of each other. At least I get a kick out of him. I hope he feels the same. But I remember thinking not long ago, I was setting up my garage. I'm picked up a new hobby where I'm restoring cars. And I set up my garage where I have a radio out there, plus I can play the internet and yada, yada. And I remember for a little bit when I was trying to get this antenna tuned in, the only station I could really get was either, I think, Star or PLR. They came in loud and clear, so I was using them to really test. And I was listening to Lappy for several afternoons, like really listening. And I said to Wiggy, like a week later, I said, it just occurred, I'm ashamed to say this, but it just occurred to me, he's really good at what he does. And I could see why he's lasted so long. I really felt like I was listening after a couple of days. I really felt like I was listening to my old buddy Lappy. Right. He was just probably reading, but he was connecting is what I'm saying. And the same thing when I listened to you guys in the morning. It's like you have your people, you know what I mean? And you could tell they take a bullet for you. And it's, what it's like. You're in the car every day and you flip on Chaz and AJ and there they are. And there's something very familiar about it. You're not alone. And what made PLR special, I think, is the fact that, first of all, they got a killer signal. Not everybody has that. So you can get them loud and clear. But the people they put on the air, it's not just, hey, Billy Michaels with you. It's, another real guy, and he's going to be there for years and years. And we make relationships. And I think that's what makes PLR special. They let their people connect with the listener.
Well, here's to another 50. And, Mark, thanks for all the memories listening to you and then being in the building with you at PLR and just being friends with you after. Mark Kaplow, thank you, brother.
My pleasure. Anytime, my friend. God bless.